now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to what I think is the 40th Ruck podcast of the season and the last from home. As from next week, for 3 weeks, we'll be broadcasting from our studio in Johannesburg. In other words, Owen Slot's hotel room. Thanks for staying with us. Thanks for downloading us today. And like Saracens and Leinster, we're going to go out at the top. No big panel today, just one man. Ben Ryan, none other, the coach of Fiji, in their brilliant gold medal run at the Rio Olympics. People think that with a talent there, Ben, it must be the easiest job in world rugby. But when you got there, you found not only was it the most difficult and the most testing, but an unbelievable journey. And in the end, the gold medal, an unbelievable feat.
Yeah, it was. Now, you're right. I mean, the talent is everywhere in Fiji, but there were a few things we had to do to get them all aligned and pointing in the right direction. And you know, like the first 48 hours, it was made aware to me that I wasn't going to get paid for 5 months, that the union had gone into bankruptcy, that the World Rugby had investigating them at the time and had stopped all funding, that my boss was Frank Bainimarama, who had had his coup in 2006, so he was still officially a dictator at the time. His son-in-law was soon to be appointed as chairman, and he was sent to prison for kicking and punching someone to death at a wedding and served manslaughter charges. And we had one player that had a bit of black magic thrown on his legs so he couldn't stand up, and he found him in the village. So things definitely got better from there.
And the first, I think the first time you went to a tournament, Kalepi Namua, a guy you had very much had your eyes on, broke his leg badly as you were watching. You followed him to the hospital just to find out the systems that they would appertain there.
Yeah.
When you got there, you found his parents were taking him away. They took him to a witch doctor and they wrapped leaves around his leg.
Yeah, and he had a spiral fracture, so his fib was out of his skin and foot in the wrong direction, and there was only one thing to do, really. But yeah, they took him off the gurney and took him away, and they went up into the interior. The healer pushed his bone back in and then wrapped it with these leaves, and thought, you know, that was the best thing to do. And I knew he wouldn't be able to play again for the Fiji team. He's back playing now, and he's not running in circles either, but he's got a bowed leg and he hasn't quite gone to the levels that he was. And yeah, there was so much I had to find out in my early days. And so I did that. I looked and didn't make any big decisions. I wanted to see what was going on and get as much information as I could before I started making any big decisions.
The whole thing, the whole odyssey and the journey is contained in a book Ben's written. It's called Seven's Heaven, The Beautiful Chaos of Fiji's Olympic Dream, out this week. And beautiful is the right word. I have to say, Ben, sparing your blushes, it is a beautiful book. It's one of the best rugby books I think there's ever been written. It's full of colour. It reminds us, I think, that rugby's gone so far down the route of systems now that it ignores skills. Is that what you encounter when you arrive in Fiji? Skills and an aversion to systems?
And mindset and wanting to play with a smile on your face. And, you know, there is a lot of it actually is linked to culture on the island. So there's this phrase they say called Senga Mataka, no tomorrow, you know. And that can be bad, because if there's a free bar, that bar gets emptied. And if there's a buffet, if you're not careful, there's piled high with food because they're not sure if it'll be there tomorrow. But that's the way they approach the game. You know, they'll throw an offload, an audacious offload, and support lines, and because they're in the present and they're enjoying themselves, and because they do that all the time, because they have the understanding of where people should be, you know, more often than not, as we saw at the weekend into the Barbarians, it works. And all the stuff that I had to go through off the field as soon as you step on the field and you start coaching the boys, it's just almost like a spiritual occasion where it's so much fun that it just completely floods over anything negative.
The other thing I was the impression I get from 7-7 from Ben's book is that actually it's a magnificent rugby book, but it's way more than the rugby book because it's about everything to do with different cultures and clashing cultures and cultures that none of us really, even though we think we know about it, we don't. But just before we come back to the book, the endless stream of talented players, Ben. We were talking just before about the Barbarians and Randrada. Is that
good? Yeah.
And Joshua Tuisova, one of your team.
Yeah.
And the glory of this line of players never stops, does it?
No, you know, because it's national sport, and not just in Fiji, but in Samoa and Tonga as well. And so the very best athletic ability want to play. And a lot of them will come through the sevens because that's really the highest level they can play on the island. And then they've got to go overseas to play professional rugby. So, and the money that they can earn can be massively significant. So I lost a load of players in my first year, and you get, you know, a Lapani Bottia, you know, that was magnificent, and he goes to La Rochelle. It's changed his family, his village. Everything's changed for him. So at no point will I ever say don't do that because I can see what a difference it makes. And you go around the islands, and I remember once looking in the Fiji Times, they have a calendar for what's going on at the weekend, and there were over 50 sevens tournaments across the islands. Mm. And I thought, wow, this is unbelievable, because I bet in every tournament there's probably a world-class sevens player there somewhere. Mm. And so I travelled and got to as many islands as I could and watch that talent. And then it was just about smartening up a few things, giving them some good standards, trusting them, giving them an environment where they could do what they wanted to do with a smile on their face. Mm. And then you see some magical stuff because, you know, we can talk. They hadn't practiced much, the Barbarians team, and they were coming from different nationalities, but immediately they had a mindset to want to play, to want to offload, to support the ball, to not die with the ball. All things that I see in the village is when I'm going to work in the morning and it might be a 15-year-old kid with a 55-year-old all playing together on an uneven undulating pitch with a plastic bottle, and they're playing this one-touch offloading game. Mm. And they just want to play. They just want to play. You're not gonna be at a beach in Fiji, and they're gonna be doing some sealing off or breakdown skills.
I know that you can give too much credence to a barbarian game, but there was a kind of brutal contrast between the two teams. I mean, one was playing for fun, and they'd obviously had fun in the bars, etc. Before the game. But just going back to this skills and systems thing. How did we get so far down the route in the whole of rugby, sevens and 15s, to systems?
Well, I think, you know, that what we've done, I was playing for the mighty West Hartlepool in the first year of professional rugby, and we went from twice a week to every day, and no one really knew what to do. We used to go to the gym and have a cup of tea and sit in the sauna and trying to fill up our time like that. And Mark Ring was juggling eggs at 2 a.m. at training camp. And we just didn't know, you know, we could fill up. And so what's happened is they filled it with systems.
Yeah.
And, you know, my saying, you know, thicker playbooks equal thicker players. And that's what we've got to now, because there are so many systems. And I watch someone like Elliot Daly, who is a teenager. I've watched him grow as a player. He's got a skill set, but he's playing within a system that's stifling that. Mm. And so it was a system led game on one side, and then just I remember Ashton telling me about it. Heads up rugby is such a, like, everyone should be playing with a head up, but I just mean they were going forward, not accepting the tackle, playing to space, supporting the ball, all those sort of things, and reacting. And if you are playing a system-based game where it's all about multi-phase, then you are just expecting that ball carrier to go to the floor and not expecting the ball. And every barbarian wasn't doing that. It was doing the opposite. Summed it up to me where they were running down the right-hand side, and Justin Tipperick went down the right-hand side and had this just sublime offload. Mm. You know, now,
sort of almost over his head.
Wasn't it? Yeah. And it was so late, and it was beautiful. And they expected it and scored a try from it. But you're looking at that, and if you froze that and you kind of superimpose that into a lot of international games or prem games, you'd see that guy holding onto the ball, creating a long barrier or sealing it off, and the next man coming in to form that pod to play another phase. Mm. And that, for me, summed up the entire game by Justin's movement there. That's mindset difference.
To put full stop on the English season, also, Saracens and Exeter finished the season. Saracens, ironclad, really, had so many injuries, but didn't they finish on a sort of emphatic note?
I'm lucky enough sometimes to be able to go to both, to all these different environments. And I think Exeter and Saracens have both got terrific environments. Mm. What we saw was probably Exeter's end of a chapter now, that they need to evolve more. Mm. They have a great culture. They have some excellent players, a really great staff that just need to get beyond what they're doing now, because it's just become too predictable and teams can suffocate. And Saracens, with the ball, they change their point of attack just with more variation. They've got some terrific players. They're very well coached. It's great to hear today that they've had contract extensions for nearly their entire staff. Happy staff, happy culture. When you go into you go into where they're training, everyone's shaking their hands and talking to you and asking you, and it's just great. And they peaked perfectly, and they were sublime. They are better than the England team in every respect at the moment.
Yeah, sure, I agree with that. I'm glad two of us have said that. Now maybe Eddie will stop blaming me. Leinster continued their domination with a big win over Llanelli. Another thing that's coming up this week, Ben, is the penultimate round of the World 7 Series, HSB World 7 Series. And so I wanted to talk to you about that, because it's at Twickenham, and I don't know, it never seems to sit as easily at Twickenham as it does at Hong Kong and all around the world. I mean, look, I've been to two or three. I'm very, very, very lucky. There's always great fun at Twickenham. Like, 2 years ago, my son went dressed as Van Gerwen, the darts player. Is it a giant piss up more than it is an affection for sevens?
I think it has become like that in some of the venues. I think there's always going to be outliers. Historically, and for other reasons, Hong Kong's always going to sit separately to everywhere else. But the format's is too long now. Even if you're completely addicted to the game of sevens, to sit and watch 45 plus games, for too long, 12 hour periods plus, is too much. They need to shorten the format. They have to make it a little bit. I mean, I'm not talking about the actual games of 14 minutes, but I'm talking about the number of games. They need to think of a quicker way to do it, maybe straight knockout like they used to do at Middlesex Sevens. I know there's travel around that, but ultimately it's got to be a lot shorter, because I can turn on the TV and watch for 4 hours. I might not know what's going on, and I might not even get to watch my team play. Mm. And at the stadium, it had become too alcohol-fueled. Twickenham, and then they reached that point where they had to just shut it all down and go back to basics again. Now they're building it up again, and I hope they learn their lessons, fill the stadium, but make it about the rugby a bit more. It's going to be great this weekend, because it's a knife edge at the top of the tree. You've got Fiji and South Africa fighting it out at the top. Mm. And I'm seeing on Instagram that Randranda and Tuisova in the Fiji Sevens camp, which just is a horrifying, if you're facing those two at centre and wing, I wish you all the very best of luck. And South Africa have got Siyabela Senatla back from Super Rugby, who is a Rolls Royce of a player on the wing. He runs so beautifully, he scores tries, and they've been battered by injuries and Super Rugby commitments. They lost Quagga Smith, who's now looks like he might earn his full cap.
In the Springbok team, yeah.
So they're hanging on in there, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens next weekend, because you are going to see some star talent. And weirdly, I tweeted about the Sevens boys that are playing for the Barbarians, but you could have had ex-international Sevens players from Barbarians. You had Lobe, Vito and Tuparik. That's not a bad Sevens pack. And then you could have had Laidlaw and Randranda and Tuisova and Fekitoa as well, played for Tonga back in the day before he then went across the All Blacks.
Sure.
Is this still the right development tool if we hadn't completely crucified it when the EPS came in? And unfortunately, when that was all done, Sevens disappeared from all the pathways, and it's not the solution to everything, but it's a nice add-on for certain players at certain times.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Ben, let's just talk about England, because whenever I see England play, when you were a coach of the Sevens team and subsequent, they are unbelievably dedicated, rather charming guys, quick, like people like Dan Norton. The number of tries he scored is beyond belief. But they don't actually impinge enough on the national consciousness here, there's only one tournament that's in England. But what's the answer to that? You talk about pathway. Should we put it back on the pathway?
In my opinion, yeah. So to give a real quick historical summary, 2007-ish when EPS came in, and before that, we could use two things, the old World Reg or IRB Reg 9 that allowed Sevens was on that to include it for international release. And also there was I could pull in players, young, talented players from all the Prem clubs. There was an agreement. EPS disappeared. So gone were the chances of getting your Danny Cares, Ben Foden, Hugo Monyas, James Haskells. They all went from that program. And then we went down to Reg 9. And that meant I brought in the Exeter Chiefs and the Cornish Pirates and those boys in the Championship, the best young. And then Reg 9 went. And that left them with only one decision. They had to try to go to full-time Sevens players, because that was the only way. I could have gone to Old Wimbledonians, asked for a player, and under Reg 9, they wouldn't have had to release. So we went to that, and they didn't bother putting any pathways in at all. And I fought tooth and nail to try to put some plans in place. But, you know, at the time at Twickenham, if you sign off something that maybe has long-term implications, they were very worried about that. And
why would they be worried about that?
Because it's accountability, and they didn't like to become accountable for some of the planning, and they decided just to go year by year with Sevens. And that meant that there was no pathway. And they either need to create that pathway, because I've got lots of mates that teach Sevens in schools, and they say that it's growing at a fantastic rate. And now you only got to go to National Sevens at Roslyn Park, and it's just brilliant. But there's no real pathway in. And then at the top end, they could have done something to renegotiate to get some of those younger players. And I look at someone like a Gabriel Ibatoyi that's playing age group and probably won't maybe make the start inside at Quinns at the start of the season, but to get some international experience to play against wingers that are world class coming through from the islands and various others would be brilliant as part of the pathway. And, you know, the Trinders, the Johnny Mays, those guys, I was knocking on club doors all the time to try to get them, and they were ending up sitting on benches or playing A-League rugby. And I didn't want to have them for a long time. I just wanted them to have a slice of that, add the quality and put it in the pathway.
Have you not hit the nail on here? There's two interesting things you put up there. We'll have a separate program on why you'd want James Haskell for the Sevens, but we'll do that another time. and secondly, the governing body of English rugby didn't want to be accountable, which is an interesting concept. If Sevens is going to be bigger and it's going to capture the imagination rather than just being a source of a drink up, you're saying they have to get serious. And you think actually they put so much money into it now, and it's Olympic sport. Yeah. Surely it's now, they must be thinking at Twickenham of putting it back on the agenda. Surely.
Well, I'd hope so. And the other thing I know, you know, when I would go in cap in hand often to DORs in the Premiership asking for, you know, one of those young players to come away with us, I'd be wearing my you know, you've got your England badge on, and they're probably having some argument higher above about something to do with a senior squad. And they might think that that player is great for his development, but because of the other fights, you don't get that player. And if they actually amalgamated, and this is another thing that, you know, but if they became Team GB, and then they would be a neutral body going into these clubs. They could probably have sponsorship, probably offer a fee for those young players, which will also keep all the various clubs happy. And it might work a lot better because, you know, the Welsh are struggling. They're about 12th or 13th, struggling to get the quality. Scotland are doing pretty well. It's cost them a lot of money. And then England are down in eighth at the moment, and their budget is significant. You know, they're touching on 2 million now. So they've really got to have a look at what they're doing.
But at the moment, at the top end of the game, the Sevens is taking place without us, really, isn't it? I mean, the top five or six are all the other teams. Yeah. That's Sevens, and it's Twickenham on Saturday and Sunday. So it'll be fun, and let's hope it's classy, and let's hope the young English does do really well. We're just going to go back to Fiji now, which is I've only ever been there once, but it's never a hardship. And you've already said that when you got there, I think the Frank Bainimarama, was the military chief, and you never quite got over your fear of the guy.
No.
Even at the end.
No.
Also, the chief executive was sacked, and then another guy around the Fijian Union was basically killed someone.
Yeah, he did.
Which has never happened at Twickenham, I'll tell you that. No. But also, there was no infrastructure or backup. You found local politics coming into it, where someone would march and say, right, these two are playing, etc. And there was no salary. So as a learning experience, hour by hour, it must have been a torrent of images and stuff.
Yeah, and brilliant at the same time. And it reminded me of when I was a really young coach, and I just tried to get every experience I could, coaching a club and a school and a county and a rep team and all these different things, just to get as much as. And I was learning tons of stuff in every respect, on the field with the players, how to up manage, because I didn't do that very well with Rob Andrew at Twickenham, and I needed to up manage a lot better. And when you got a dictator and a convicted murderer, then you get a specific set of skills you've got to get better at. And it was also the national sport. So like we talk about the England team, they're going to give it their best at Twickenham at the weekend. But if they don't win, no one's going to bat an eyelid. But if Fiji lose two games in a row or lose a final, it's going to be front back page news in the papers. You know, the old coaches would tell me their house would get stoned if they came back and hadn't won a tournament. And luckily, we had success quite early. I still had threatening phone calls at different points in time, and you'll always have your guys that think that you know, I'm part of the old empire. I learned things on a day-to-day basis, and I also came into the England setup because I thought a bit creatively. I'd worked my way through with Newbury Rugby Club and different others, and Brian Ashton had mentored me, and I thought differently. And then I got sort of battered a bit by the bigger machine at Twickenham, and very slowly. So I wasn't aware of it.
Didn't you realise it was happening?
No,
to you?
And by the end of the year, I was, you know, I remember stepping onto the field once in training, going, I hadn't even thought about what I was about to do on the field, and that was what I was paid for, not the screaming and shouting in boardrooms. And when we got to the World Cup Sevens final in my last tournament in charge, I didn't feel any joy at all. I knew I had to go. And so Fiji, like with all that stuff that we talked about, it was a blank page.
But also it was far more than just rugby, because you say in the book that you gradually had to discard the paraphernalia of modern life. You're talking about you slightly missed the buzz of London, but there was no, you know. There was no mobile phone. At least you couldn't have your mobile phone all day. There was dead. There were no cars going by your house. There was dead silence. And actually, it was a life linked to nature and the sea, because you were on the seafront and etc. And also, you had to get used to Fiji time, which basically was what we call it, probably Manyala elsewhere. But Fiji time, there was no. If you made an appointment, it was all really a basis for negotiation rather than an appointment, wasn't it?
Yeah, and if it is important, it will happen. And if it don't turn up, then it probably wasn't that important anyway. You know, that's. And I had to get used to all of that. Obviously, I had to instill in the boys in training that Fiji time didn't exist. They had to be on time, and they got all that pretty quickly. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it was weird. Some of those things where you just at night and there is no noise, where the simple things become really important. I remember, you know, to really have an extreme version when the cyclone came in. Cyclone Winston is the biggest cyclone to ever hit in the Southern Hemisphere, second biggest recorded of all time, twice the power of Katrina in New Orleans back then. And things got destroyed. Two of the boys lost their houses, family houses, and they all came in to camp 5 days later, bar one, who just physically just wasn't possible. And their attitude was, well, we didn't have much to start with, so we'll just rebuild. And they were genuinely felt like that, and they were happy. And so, you know, 3 years previous, when I'm in Southwest London worrying about which restaurant to order takeaway from, or what box set to watch, or what red wine to drink, I'm like, I got this wrong, my priorities. And I hadn't become a very good version of myself, I think. And Fiji gave me that reset button, and God, I'm so pleased that they did.
And you also talk about, you know, instead of saying, right, I'll go to the freezer or a takeaway, that meals became not difficult, but you had to plan a meal. If you're going to someone, you'd all go along and you'd all cook and you'd all chat, but you'd have to plan it, because you had to almost like everyone contribute ingredients, because there just wasn't any way of doing it.
Yeah, that is exactly right. And, you know, they used to get the first of all, they'd make me laugh. The first few months I'd go somewhere and cocondo is like a coconutty spicy fish dish, and, you know, and with rice, and you get stuck in. They'd give me a knife and fork, and I'd use it at the start, and then quickly realize that actually the best way to use your hands to pick out all the bones of the fish. And they would find it funny when they would see me trying to eat and do things that more traditional way. And I'd talk about my first trip to one of the outside islands, where I had my chargers and another charger and a laptop. Yeah. And, you know, I was wearing trainers and everything. And by the time I returned to that one 12 months later, you know, I was barefoot and fancy free, and it took time to adjust. But
and you were a chief as well. You were a Ratu.
I was a Ratu. Yeah, my Fijian name is Ratu Penny Rayani Latinara, from the Saruan clan of the Latinaras. And they gave me a plot of land, and we were gonna, it says in the book, we were gonna build a resort, but actually it's gonna be leased out now, and we're gonna have a school there, which will be brilliant. Okay. So yeah, nice. I think the thing about Fijians, and you've met many of them, when they like you, they love you, and they do everything they can for you. And so, you know, it sounds very surreal that they put you on a banknote and a coin and give you chiefly status and name kids after you, but actually that's just them showing their love, and they do it, you know, on a day-to-day basis to a lot of people.
The there's so many great players there, but it's very, very instructive to for any coach that you really did treat them as individuals. If someone wanted to had a chocolate problem, or you wanted chocolate all the time, instead of saying no chocolate, you'd sort of go along with him and buy a bar of chocolate and do it that way. I mean, you seem to treat everyone in different ways, and they responded in different ways, but they all responded.
Yeah, they did. You had to find different, and it came down to, in a real quick story, we were doing, I knew that if I got them fit, number one, got them fit, didn't cost any money, they would be able to do what they do on the field just for longer periods. Mm. So we got them fit, and we were doing these sprints up and down the pitch, and I just looked like there were less numbers every time we were doing it, and I could see there was rustling in the bushes. Boys were hiding in the bushes. So I was grabbing them, kicking them out. And one of them was very talented, Jerry Tuwai. So I thought I'd take him home and find out a bit more about him. And we drove to Suva, and he lives in a settlement called Newtown. You know, he learned to play on a roundabout, how to play rugby. I remember after the Olympics, a German journalist said to him, you know, you must have loved playing on the beaches. He just showed him the soles of his feet and all the scars he'd got from the tarmac, and go, now this, I told him, explained all that. And I went to his settlement, and his mum and dad lived in a one room, corrugated, long drop round the back. Didn't think they had a generator at the time. So, and sat down and talked to them and said, like, your son is incredibly talented, but he didn't connect training to playing. He just wants to play. And if he doesn't get fit, he's not going to be able to do what he does on a regular basis. And they told me, 13 years old, he would sell fish on the side of the street as Vunissa and Poessa, his mum and dad. His dad would dive for the fish, bring them up, sell them. And Jerry would sell them on the side of the road. And when he was 15, he went to see his mum and said, I want to play rugby. This is my dream. And he didn't she didn't say, right, don't be daft, you've got to earn money. And the four or five other brothers and sisters, they went without food, the mum and dad. They went, bought the cheapest pair of boots. They gave him his pair of boots, said, left boot, said, this is your knife. Other boot, this is your fork. It said, this is what you're going to use to put food on the table for us. And he had that written underneath each boot when he made his international
debut. So one boot was knife, the other was fork.
Yeah. And he scored in the Olympic final. He's now captain of the Fiji Sevens team. Mm. And it reminded, you know, after that, and I was I was speechless, really, for, you know, and I realized so many things, that this kid wasn't lazy. At 13, I was having my lions and playing table tennis with my mates. I certainly wasn't selling fish and earning money for my family. And so I thought, right, I've got to go and do that with all the players. And with Rapati Calvesi, our manager, who was
Rapati was your chief lieutenant and soulmate, really.
Yeah, he was. He was. And he's just such a lovely man. And him and Osea Kulinasel, my captain, who I feel very grateful. I wouldn't have survived there without him.
He was seen as a bad boy, and they didn't want you to pick him.
No, that's right. They told me he was a troublemaker because he stood up for the boys, you know, because they would go and win a tournament. They'd come back to Nandi Airport, be a big cardboard cut out of a check saying 20,000 Fijian for the boys, and then that's it. It did disappear. So yeah. Oscar, you know, asked questions, difficult ones. They didn't like to answer.
The money would disappear.
Well, they just never got it. Always late or didn't happen. And, you know, it's... It's all, you know, it was all into the ether. And so I went to see Oscar and met in his dad, Tui, who is also an amazing man, and instantly got on with him. We didn't have to say much. There was just something. It was serendipitous, a bit like a lot of things.
But Ben, you talk about the effect you had on them, and then you've also talked in the book about the effect that they had on you. And you were saying that the other teams on the circuit, they'd have... I think you said they had compression tights, they do ice baths, all sorts of warm downs. And you said your guys would just go and jump in a pool. You go to a waterfall, jump in a pool and just splash around in there. And that actually, I think the more it went on, the more you realised that some of the other teams are just too serious. You talk about some of the other teams on the circuit having this blast of sort of aerobic stuff just before the kickoff, which the Lions did. What's all that about? And then you got a guy, a PhD student, and who proved that was absolutely complete rubbish. Didn't work.
Yeah.
So actually, you stripped down a lot, but not only because they were Fijians, but because the whole game had taken too much on.
Yeah, way too much. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to go to other sports organisations around the world at the moment. And the really good ones, you know, they have bottomless pit money where they get all their gadgets and everything else. And they've suddenly realised that there's just so much noise around their systems. There's not enough signal. It's not. And they're cutting everything down again. Mm. And they've had to go on this little journey. And we're doing it as a sport, I think, because we're 30 years behind what's happening in North American sport. We're making these mistakes. Every time you turn on a GPS, you get 100 pages of information, you know, and if you're not careful, you spend all your days worrying about that. And I think if you have a 14-minute game of sevens, if you watch it once with them and you can't work out what's going wrong after, you know, you'd have to keep rewinding it and cutting it up and analysing it and having one-on-ones, you're barking up the wrong tree. So simple can, you know, simple's not always easy to get to, but it is what I saw with Fiji, and often, you know, it doesn't cost any money to do these changes. And yeah, it's a lot of stuff you do is kind of counterintuitive, I think.
You won the World Series, Seven Series twice. You're coming into the Olympics and massive publicity. They've never won a medal before, etc. When you reach the final, you didn't play brilliantly all the way through, but you reach the final on finals day. The guys are all splashing in the pool again. And you, I'm sure you were honest where you say you weren't actually in a panic about it.
No.
And that must have been a great feeling, because somewhere deep down, you must have known that you'd done enough, but not too much. And the boys were probably going to win it.
Yeah, I did. I'm not for one second lying. I just felt very, very relaxed and confident with what the boys, how the boys were. And I remember going to that swimming pool where they were splashing around and throwing people in. And it was, I don't know what time it was, 8:30 in the morning. And we were sharing the accommodation with Australia and other Pacific teams. And I, on purpose, got there late because I wanted to show Nadar, our conditioner, that I trusted him 100%. Got there late. The boys were laughing and singing, saying it's going to be a great day. And they didn't. They were just so excited.
Were the New Zealand team in the pool with you, with Gordon Titchens?
They had been knocked out the night before.
Oh, right.
So I got on well with all those New Zealand boys, and I could see when they were walking around that they had just been overworked, and it all got, they weren't playing their natural, the way they wanted to play. And I think if anybody had been that last 40, 35, 30 minutes before the game, the final, had just been just hovering around our changing room and Great Britain's and watching the warm-ups and then going into the tunnel to see the two teams, you'd have said exactly what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It was night and day how one team was relaxed and the other was uptight.
You go out in the final and not only have you you've won a gold medal, not even a bronze, it wasn't a bronze or silver, all those thousands of miles away, you must have felt it at home.
Mm.
That you must have realised exactly what was going on there.
Yeah,
back
yeah, I did. And it was, you know, when we eventually did fly back, it was ridiculous, yeah. You know, the whole country. And, you know, you're on your open-top bus going through various parts of Fiji and you've got every national, you know, it's fairly multicultural, Fiji, you know, half the population's Indian as well. Yeah. And you've got all different types of ethnicities all side by side laughing and clapping and waving. And, you know, Frank wanted to get rid of the Fijian flag because it had the Union Jack on it and he's not a big fan of the UK. And, because of the amount of flags that were being waved, they reversed their decision and they kept it. And it's a beautiful flag, I think. And you know, the Union Jack, it's got nothing to do with it's the part of the history. And, it was amazing. And as the boys sort of sum it up, you know, it's this tiny dot in the middle of the South Pacific. But for those brief moments in the Olympics where it was Google's most searched word for an hour, everyone's really proud. And because the boys come from the people, they're not going off then to play professionally. Most of them are on the island. They've, you know, they've been hotel porters. They've been policemen, army, teachers, unemployed, fishermen, farmers. The people can relate to them very, you know, it's a very unique team.
But apart from the way they're centred, these guys like Colonisa, Kunitani, Nakarawa, Tuasova, did they still make you go, wow, even though you knew what, you know, there must have been times when even if you didn't plan it, you must have been staggered now and again by what they could do.
Yeah, there were times, and there weren't one or two. You know, I'd run out of digits to the amount of times that I was a supporter on the side of the field. Mm. And I remember very clearly in my first year in Hong Kong where we were 5 points up coming into half time, got a penalty directly in front of the post, and I was screaming, kick the points. That's two scores, kick the points. They completely ignored me. Couple of audacious offloads later, they'd scored under the posts, and it reminded me, keep my mouth shut, because it's about them. They make decisions on the field. That's what I should be. That's what I think I'm trying to do as a coach. So you've got to, you know, like Oscar will tell you, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. But more often than not, they wave that thing around pretty handily.
What about, it wasn't all a good news story with your experience. I mean, there were obviously difficulties. Mm. Also, You talk very movingly about your ex-wife, Natalie, and you know, you clearly felt for her because you were caught up in this whirlwind. But I think in the end, I think what you're trying to say is with a tribute to Natalie that it just possibly you weren't meant to be together and it wasn't the Olympics that pushed you apart?
No, it wasn't. I think Fiji, if anything, sort of showed us that, you know, and I don't want to get corny, but, you know, you get one crack at life and you want to be happy. And I wasn't giving her the happiness that she really deserved and she didn't, and we didn't quite fit. And we made that decision really. And for me, it was all cemented by what had happened in Fiji. And I, you know, I continue to learn from the lessons I've had in Fiji. It's not all up and down. And we had players like Pio Tuwai who I had to drop before the Olympic Games and whose house was destroyed by cyclone, whose wife had died from cancer. And I was there just before that she passed and, incredibly sad. Some of the boys' backstories. But it makes everything, you're grateful for everything.
A kind of sporting sadness. You joined, an elite group. When you won the gold medal and in this aftermath of Sir Clive Woodward, Gary Street and yourself, you've all won the ultimate honour in sport. The gold medal in sevens, the World Cup for men, World Cup for women. But no one at Twickenham or anywhere else appeared to think, right, we're going to go to the top guy in the sport now and bring him in and put him in charge of everything. and so, you know, you tried to find a way to get Super Rugby going in Fiji.
Yeah.
You've got a vast talent for it. It is one of the great coaching feats of all time, the way you change what had to be changed but knew to leave what didn't have to be left.
Thank you.
You're slightly surprised that no one in authority has said, come and talk to us or head it up.
I don't know, really. I mean, there's a lot of good coaches out there, and I sort of have got this whole diet of things. I'm doing lots of really cool things. There's been a couple of jobs that I did turn down. Edinburgh offered me their head coach job last year, and I just didn't think it was quite right for me. And, you know, actually, at the other end of the scale, if the RFU said to me, Ben, come in and sort out state school rugby, and I got a free, fresh page to do something, that's sort of a life that I could commit to, that sort of thing. Yeah. Because I see what's going on in state school sport. I see what potential there is. I see how it's undervalued at the moment. And those sort of conversations I'd happily have with the RFU. And I got lots of good friends at the RFU. The guys that I clashed heads with are no longer there. And, I support England as much as anybody else. But, yeah, I've got no regrets about any of that.
Do you think that the profile it gave you has put you in a pigeonhole as a sevens coach?
I think
because throughout, you've always said to me, in an interview, sevens is not something you've got to go away for 6 months and exclusively do that. You're just a rugby player.
Yeah, I think people get really carried away, and sometimes we're guilty of it ourselves as sevens to sort of say, oh, it's this specialist subject matter that you really need all these key skills. It's rugby. You know, I was with Pete Walton earlier today. He's one of the under-18s coaches. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, it's simple, isn't it? It's run and catch and pass, isn't it? And attackers like, it is, Pete. It is, and we just need to realise that. And sevens or 15s or whatever age groups, it's all about the basic foundations and allowing the players to do what they want to do. And I get that people don't necessarily think that I can do it at 15s, but it doesn't worry me. I know I've got that capability, and if the two things align at some point in the future, then great. And if they don't, I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
Thanks for listening to The Rut today. Thank you a million times, Ben, for coming in. Ben Ryan, Seven's Heaven, The Beautiful Chaos of Fiji's Olympic Dream, is just an epic book. And I'm not saying that because he's sitting here, because if it was rubbish, I'd say so. It is just an epic book. It has so many facets to it. Rugby in general, as we learn from social media, rugby fans absolutely do not share the narrow-minded sense that rugby's only six countries. People love Fiji, Samoa, Tonga. They love Georgia coming up. This is the story of a rugby nation which, given a fair run, could be the greatest rugby nation, even if it is a tiny dot in the Pacific. And the man who helped them and took them to a gold medal has written the book. Next week, Owen and I will be back from Joburg to see if England can make something from the beautiful chaos of their current dreams. Thank you, Ben, and thank you for everyone for listening.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.